May it please the court, my name is Boone. I represent Harold Schuler, trustee and or assigned, who filed this action in the trial court. Was rendered on that verdict in Schuler's favor, decreeing specific performance of the contract to sell a 24-unit apartment located in Dallas, Texas. The Court of Appeals reversed finding, despite the findings issues, that a condition precedent to the contract had not been fulfilled. Schuler has appealed to this court. This contract was executed on April 28, 1979 by Mr. John Gordon, the seller. As I mentioned, the subject matter is a 24-unit apartment complex located in Dallas, Texas. The payment terms were essentially as follows. The purchase price was $432,000. That was to be paid with a $125,000 approximate down payment, of which $10,000 was put up as earnest money. The $306,000 balance was to be paid with a promissory note by Harold Schuler, trustee and or assigned. This $306,000 note was a wraparound note. It wrapped around a pre-existing debt on this property. The pre-existing debt was to the Boston Mutual Life Insurance Company. It was in the original principal amount of $213,000 and, as stated by the Court of Appeals, was approximately $125,000 at the time of trial. I'm not sure on those figures, and some of these are approximations, but these are what the Court of Appeals found. The contract, which was drawn by Mr. Gordon's seller's attorney, stated that it was made subject to obtaining the written approval by Boston Mutual of the transfer and consent to the wraparound lien note. During the trial, it became apparent that the seller was anxious to relieve himself of the contract almost from the word go. The contract started to run on April 28, 1979, provided for a 30-day inspection period during which the buyer could examine the premises. Mr. Gordon testified at the time of the trial that he was initially anxious to close the transaction because he needed the money to prevent the foreclosure of a note that he had in Alabama. That note, according to Mr. Gordon's testimony, was foreclosed in mid to late June 1979, and he admitted that from that point on, he did not want to close this deal. Now, actually, as early as the initial 30-day inspection period, Mr. Gordon had received an offer, another offer, to purchase this property at a price that was approximately $48,000 better than the price that he had contracted to sell this property to Schuler. When Schuler signed the contract with Mr. Gordon, Mr. Schuler took it upon himself, although the contract did not so provide, Mr. Schuler took it upon himself to secure this written approval of the Boston Mutual. He first turned over the contract, his financial statement, and the financial statements of his partner, Mr. Lou Reese, to Boston Mutual's local servicing agent in Dallas, Texas. This was a company by the name of Glenn. Boston approved the transfer of ownership of the property to Schuler on a prepayment basis. In other words, if Schuler will pay off the amount due to Boston Mutual, they will charge him a 3% penalty, and they will approve the transfer. The transaction was set up to the Boston Mutual note. In effect, the Boston Mutual note was at a 9.25% interest rate. Schuler and his partner got back in touch with a Mr. John McGovern, the mortgage officer at Boston Mutual in Boston, Massachusetts, who was in charge of this particular loan, clarified the situation, stated this is a wraparound situation. We intend to keep the Boston Mutual note in effect. At that point, July 18, 1979, the proposal was submitted to the Finance Committee of the Boston Mutual Life Insurance Company and approved on that date. On July 25, 1979, John McGovern wrote again to Glenn Justice Mortgaging Company, stating, in effect, that they had approved the transfer of ownership subject to certain conditions which were set forth in his letter.
Now, who was the letter written to?
The letter was written to a lady by the name of Nell Gurley, care of the Glenn Justice Mortgage Company, which is Boston Mutual's servicing agent in Dallas, Texas. This letter, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 20 in the trial, is the key issue on this court.
It's argued, as I understand it, by the respondent that the letter wasn't signed by anybody in the authority, it wasn't addressed to either Shuler or Gardner. That's why I asked you who was addressed to. How did they get hold of the letter?
If I might, Your Honor, I had a copy of the letter blown up so that the court could see it in a little bit more detail. The testimony was that the salesman who would work for Shuler and Reese and Company, a man by the name of Jack Petruccelli, picked this letter up from Nell Gurley on July 26th or 27th. He could not be sure of the date. He testified that he either mailed it or delivered it, and he was not sure which, to Mr. Gordon, and mailed it to Mr. Gordon's attorney, Mr. Potts.
Counsel, your eyes are apparently better than mine, at least, and I think that's a very nice exhibit, but I can't read a word of it from here, so you're going to tell us about it.
I'd be happy to, Your Honor, and I'll be glad to move it if the light is bad or it's just too small.
I think you answered Judge Barrett's question by telling us who the addressee is and so forth.
I'll do the best I can to explain it as we go. The jury...
Who was the letter to, Counsel?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't realize that you didn't hear that.
I didn't hear your answer to Justice Barrett's question.
The letter is addressed to Ms. Nell Gurley, Commercial Loan Administrator, Glenn Justice Mortgage Company. As I said, Glenn Justice Mortgage Company, the testimony showed, was the Boston Mutual's local servicing agent. In fact, in the letter which preceded this letter, it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 11 before this court, John McGovern explained why he notified Glenn Justice. He felt like that it was appropriate that the Boston Mutual notify its servicing agent and then let the servicing agent so inform the parties, Shuler and Gordon, to the contract. The jury was asked, was consent to the conveyance, and the conveyance was defined as the terms of the contract, was the consent obtained? They found yes, it was. The jury also found that Shuler was willing and able to satisfy all of the financial conditions set forth in John McGovern's letter of July the 25th. The Court of Appeals held that John McGovern's letter was not such unconditional approval as would prevent the Boston Mutual from accelerating its rights under its deed of trust, accelerating the loan. The court also held that unconditional approval was a condition precedent to the contract, although the contract did not call for unconditional approval. The Court of Appeals went on to hold that whether or not a mortgagee's consent has been obtained is a question of law rather than fact, and the fact, as found by the jury, that Shuler was willing and able to satisfy all of the financial conditions and hold Gordon harmless from those financial conditions was evidentiary and not an ultimate fact issue, found that Mr. Gordon would have been required to enter a new and different contract. Briefly, I'd like to state what the law is with regard to a mortgagee's consent. First of all, whether a mortgagee's consent to the transfer of secured property has been obtained is a question of fact. It is submitted to the jury. Cited in petitioner's brief before this court are several cases, including two Supreme Court cases, where this question was submitted either to the judge as a trier of fact or to the jury. Secondly, a mortgagee's consent to the transfer of the secured property need not be unconditional. The facts in this case were stated that it is seldom that a mortgagee consents to a transfer without putting some sort of condition upon that consent. Now, specifically, not only here, but the primary condition that we're talking about here is the most common one, and that is that they escalated the interest rate from 9.25% to 10% or such other rate as the attorney for the Boston Mutual found would not violate the usury laws of Texas. I would like to talk about the conditions set forth, the seven conditions set forth in John McGovern's letter individually. And a copy of John McGovern's letter is attached to respondent's reply as Appendix B, I believe. The first condition was that Mr. Gordon would remain personally liable and would agree to all changes. This is a two-element sentence. First of all, Mr. Gordon testified that he had no objection to being personally liable on the balance due Boston Mutual. He was already personally liable on the note. He would not be burdened financially by remaining personally liable. The element of Mr. Gordon will agree to all changes was directed by the undisputed evidence of the author of the letter to the fact that they would escalate, they would increase the interest rate from 9.25% to 10%. And I'll discuss that third condition just after discussing the condition number two. This was that Messrs. Reese and Schuler would assume the obligation of the Boston Mutual mortgage and would be personally liable for the loan amount. The testimony, undisputed, was that Reese was willing to assume this obligation. Schuler was willing to assume this. John McGovern testified that he thought there was no problem with the willingness of Schuler and Reese to assume this obligation. And the jury found, in Special Issue Number 6, that Schuler, was willing to satisfy all of the financial conditions in John McGovern's letter. That issue, the sufficiency of the facts to support that finding, is not challenged on appeal. The third condition, as I said, is probably the most important. This was that the interest rate of the note is to be modified to 10% or such rate which, in the opinion of our attorney, would not exceed any usury statute in the state of Texas. McGovern stated that this meant 10% at the most, qualified to be less if the attorney felt like that was necessary. He calculated what the increase would be in the monthly payments on the Boston Mutual note. This would have increased the payments from $1,920 before the increase up to a range which did not exceed $2,080. These were payments that would be made to Boston Mutual. The wraparound payments were initially structured to go to Mr. Gordon in the amount of approximately $2,800. It is undisputed that Mr. Reese and Mr. Schuler went to Mr. Gordon and offered to increase the amount of the wraparound note payments to Mr. Gordon by the amount that the Boston Mutual note payments would be increased. This created a problem because if Schuler and Reese should default on the note, then Gordon would receive the obligation back at the higher interest rate. At that point, Reese calculated the total amount of the increased interest that would be due, he calculated the total amount of the increase, the dollar amount from increasing the interest rate from 9.25% to 10%. This was $11,334. He offered to put this amount in an escrow account for Mr. Gordon to draw on to assure Mr. Gordon, to secure Mr. Gordon that he would not suffer any financial burden as a result of the increase in interest rate. And Mr. Gordon first stated that he heard a lot of words about this indemnification, but that he wanted to see something in writing. He did see something in writing, which was Mr. Schuler's letter dated July 27, 1979, whereby Schuler specifically offered to indemnify Mr. Gordon from the increased interest rate or any other financial detriment that Mr. Gordon might sustain as a result of the conditions that Boston Mutual might put on their consent. Again, the jury found that Shuler was willing and able to indemnify, to hold Mr. Gordon harmless from any of the financial conditions that were put upon him by the letter from John McGovern. The next four, or actually the next three conditions, are not financial conditions. These were specifically that new UCC-1 financing statements would be signed by the borrowers and filed, that a new insurance policy would be issued showing, again, Boston Mutual as their mortgage interest, and then finally that a deed of conveyance would be sent to them for their files. Mr. Gordon testified that he objected only to the conditions that put some additional financial burden on him. And the testimony was, I believe, that these conditions would be the type of things that would be met at closing. In other words, the deed would be filed and then sent to Boston, Massachusetts for their file. The seventh condition of John McGovern's letter is that our attorney, James Blanchett, will prepare and be satisfied with all documents. His fees and expenses in this matter will be paid by the borrowers. Mr. Gordon testified that he understood from the outset that the attorney's fees would be paid by Shuler and Reese. They would be, in effect, the new borrowers. That is not an objection. Mr. Gordon testified that he did object because he didn't know what documents Mr. Blanchett would draw, what they would provide. The documents were received by a letter dated August 28, 1979. They were reviewed at the time of trial by Mr. Gordon and by Mr. Reese, and both found that the only financial burden in those documents was again the increase in the interest rate from 9.25% to 10%. It is Shuler's position that Gordon was not required to enter a new and different contract because Shuler was willing and able to take all of the burdens that were imposed by Boston Mutual's consent off the shoulders of Mr. Gordon, that the contract was exactly the same for Mr. Gordon, and that this was not and that the financial conditions imposed by the Boston Mutual's letter of consent were not Mr. Gordon's reason for refusing to close this transaction. Mr. Gordon lists as additional reasons some aspects of this consent which are not addressed by the Court of Appeals. And very briefly, I would cover those because he's argued these in his brief. The first goes to form. Mr. Gordon has stated that this letter cannot be dignified into the type of consent that is binding upon parties to a transaction of this magnitude. That sort of dignified consent could only be found in what was styled the Note Amendment and Assumption Agreement, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 13 before this court. Mr. McGovern testified that this is their form of written consent. He knew of no other way to evidence their consent to a transfer of ownership than a letter of this type. He's been a mortgage officer with the Boston Mutual Life Insurance Company for more than 11 years and has written approximately 120 such letters. With regard to the note amendment and assumption agreement, this is the type of instrument that would be signed at closing, not a consent that had to be obtained prior to closing. Finally, the cases don't require formal consent. Consent is found in the cases in the form of a letter, such as this, from the mortgagee, in a telegram, and even a telephone call to a disinterested party. It's Shuler's position that if Mr. Gordon can refuse to close this transaction because he objected to the form of the consent, then the contract was never enforceable in the first place.
And Counsel, what about the time? Closing date was agreed to be July 27th. And this letter was written from someplace on July the 25th and apparently was received, maybe the next day or on the day of closing. How do you comply with the closing date? Time may not be of the essence,
But when did Schuler call on Mutual for this consent? Why did they wait till 2 days before closing?
Your Honor, there is no contention that Schuler was remiss in his dealings with the Boston Mutual. He started from, as I said earlier, the word go, trying to obtain the Boston Mutual's consent. They initially got the wrong type of consent because it anticipated a prepayment. But Schuler and Reese started at a very early stage to try to obtain this consent. Now, the testimony with regard to the time element, Schuler has a threefold argument here. First of all, assuming that the critical time is, as Mr. Gordon contends, July 27, 1979, there is substantial evidence to sustain the jury's finding that this letter was obtained on or before that date. That evidence is in the form of the testimony of Jack Petrocelli, who testified...
Counsel, the agreement was not that they'd get approval, but the transaction would be closed. After they got the letter, there was still a lot of billing. Had to get some insurance, had to draw some documents, had to do a number of things.
Your Honor, the condition precedent was that they would obtain the letter prior to closing. The closing date was not a condition precedent to this contract.
I understand, but you had a contract that this would be closed on a certain date. What do we do, just forget about that?
Your Honor, you don't just forget about it, and we say that there's evidence that they met, that they were prepared to close on that certain date. We also contend that that date is not all that certain. This relates to the fact or the use by Mr. Gordon's attorney of the word such date. The contract was closed within, it initially said 20 days after approval of seller's title by the title company, Perrin, but not earlier than 30 days after the date of execution hereof by seller, close Perrin, and at all events shall close on or before 90 days after such date. If this court finds that there is no evidence that Jack Petrocelli's testimony that he picked this letter up on July 26th or 27th was not credible or was not entitled, is no more than a scintilla of evidence, then it is Schuler's position that the date, the outside date of closing, is 90 days from the date of approval of seller's title. Now, to understand this argument, I must back up and explain to the court that the seller's title was never approved until sometime the following year. He contracted to convey this land subject only to the debt to Boston Mutual. In fact, there was a $40,000 lien placed against this land, which was of no concern to Mr. Gordon, but a great concern to Mr. Schuler and a great concern to the title company, and it was not released by Mr. Gordon until sometime in 1980. There was testimony that the date of closing referred to the date of approval of seller's title, not necessarily the date of execution. It's our contention that it is a reasonable construction of the word such, which in and of itself means nothing. It must refer back to another word, that a reasonable construction of that word would include the date of approval of seller's title, in which case July 27, 1979 is not the magic date. But at any rate, the jury found that the parties did not consider time to be of the essence. July 27, 1979, 90 days from approval of seller's title, that was not critical to the parties to this transaction. Time was not of the essence.
Well, it seemed to be critical to the seller, because on August the 12th, 15 days later, he said no deal. Suppose he had written his letter 60 days. How long could you go beyond the contract time?
Your Honor, the case law supports the fact that you can go a reasonable time beyond the contract time. The jury found that McGovern's letter was obtained within a reasonable time. We submit that when Mr. Gordon refused to close in mid-August, he thought he had an out. He had been looking for a way to escape this contract since May of 1979, and he thought he had found it. He thought he had found it in either the conditions of set forth in John McGovern's letter, or he thought he had found it in the magic date, July 27, 1979. We submit that Mr. Gordon did not find a way out, and this court should enforce the decree ordering specific performance of the contract. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. The argument from the respondent.
That legal court, Mr. George Fox,
may it please the court, counsel. My name is George Garrison Potts, and I practice law with Golden Potts, Beckman & Wilson in Dallas. I'm the attorney for Mr. Gordon in this case. At the outset, I'd like to correct one little error in the Court of Appeals opinion. They erred, the court erred in one respect and one respect only. The balance due on the note was not $125,000, it was closer to $190,000, which is very material. Now, in approaching this case, I approached it with a firm conviction that under no circumstances, under no view of the case, could the McGovern Gurley letter constitute a consent sufficient to meet the requirements of the condition preceding contained in the earnest money contract. And I almost overlooked something that probably is fairly essential to the case, and the Court of Appeals did not overlook it. And that is that the decision of whether the McGovern Gurley letter was or was not a consent sufficient to meet the requirements of the condition preceding is a question of law for decision by the court and not for the jury. I've examined the cases that are cited in the Court of Appeals opinion, and they fully sustain that position. In addition to which, there are other Texas cases that sustain that position that have not been cited in my brief or otherwise cited in the case. And I'd, if the clerk's here, I'd wish they'd take the citation down. Other cases that so hold are American National Insurance versus Tri-Cities Construction at 551 Southwestern 2nd, 106.
Counsel, instead of relying on the clerk or anybody else, it would be well for you to furnish us a letter brief giving us the citation.
I'll furnish you a letter brief giving you the citations and gladly skip the citations. The other case is Gulf States Equipment versus Tombs. Now, the best exposition of the rationale of the court in reaching this conclusion is contained in the Crane versus Colonial Holding Corporation cited in the Court of Appeals opinion. The court there, in ruling on whether a commission agent or a finder had fully fulfilled his contract of employment, stated, in the first place, should not have been submitted to the jury, because the rule is that when the facts are undisputed, the question of whether or not they constitute a performance or breach of the contract is one of law for the court. Now, in this particular case, I've rarely seen a more classical case where this is true, because the court here is confronted with the earnest money contract, an unambiguous contract, providing a condition precedent. The court is also presented not with a bunch of facts of conduct, statements, and so forth, but with a writing, which the plaintiff contends meets the requirements of the condition precedent. It seems clear to me that the task of construing the earnest money contract and determining if this McGovern Gurley letter satisfies the condition preceding is clearly a question of law for the court, and any finding, the issue should not have been submitted to the jury, and any finding to the jury of the jury should be disregarded on that point. Now,
think it would help us if you just tell us which ones of these fouls up the field.
What deficiencies exist in the McGovern-Gurley letter? Is that what your inquiry is? All right, I'll talk about that then. Now, the obvious purpose of the condition preceding calling for the consent is to protect the parties against a declaration of default by the Boston Mutual with consequent possibility of acceleration and foreclosure. The Boston Mutual hadn't been stated, but the Boston Mutual mortgage had a due on sale clause and it had a prohibition against creation of any junior mortgages. And the obvious purpose of this condition is to be sure that they are not obliged to close a contract that would create a default. The contract also provides that in paragraph special condition 1C, that this agreement shall terminate, if the consent is not obtained, this agreement shall terminate and the earnest money shall be refunded. The time for performance, time for closing this contract, is stated to be 90 days from the date of execution of the contract, which was April 28th. July 27th is the last day for performance of this contract. Now, with this context, let's look at this so-called consent and see where it fails. But what we've got to do, we've got to test the transaction as it stood on the last day of the period of time in which the contract remained in force, the ultimate closing date of July 27th. Now, I would ask the court to assume, for the purposes of argument, that the McGovern-Gurley letter was in the hands of Mr. Shuler or one of his associates on that last day. Now, that is an assumption.
Well, it'd need to go to Mr. Gardner, wouldn't it?
Well, I would think so, yes, Your Honor. But assuming that it was in their hands, and that's an assumption that is hard to make for this reason, that in our Court of Appeals brief, we review the testimony at pages 40 and 48 of our brief, and I submit to the court that there is no affirmative testimony that it was picked up by Petruccelli on any day. He said he didn't remember the date that he picked it up. Moreover, and this to me is an astonishing thing, on July the 27th, the last day for performance of this contract, Mr. Shuler, realizing that it was the last day, wrote to Mr. Gordon and signed it, a letter requesting an extension of the contract. In that letter, Mr. Shuler, over his signature, said, quote, such approval has not been received in writing as of the date hereof. So I have trouble assuming, even for the purpose of argument, that the letter was in the hands of Mr. Petruccelli on July 27th. But let's assume that nonetheless, and consider the consequence would have been if Mr. Gordon and Shuler had closed the deal there. After that, we see that there is a condition that the interest rate on Mr. Gordon's note is to be increased from 9.25 to 10. A condition that Mr. Gordon might not wish to agree to. In fact, I thoroughly believe that he would not want to agree to it. Mr. Boone states that it cost him $11,000 over the life of the contract. Mr. Boone argues that Mr. Shuler offered to indemnify him. But an indemnity is no better than the balance sheet of the person affording the indemnity. There are still risks involved. He argues, too, that Mr. Reese calculated the interest and agreed to escrow that in cash. That is true, but that offer was made after the earnest money contract had expired by expiration of the 90 days.
That is after July 27th?
It's after July 27th.
What day did he offer to do that? Just what you got to press in mind?
I don't have the, I don't think the evidence shows what date it was, except that it was after July 27th.
I mean, a matter of a few days, or
I think
when this lawsuit's filed? Or?
I think it's a matter of a few days, probably. I wouldn't argue that it was much later, because the discussions between them terminated in mid-August when Mr. Gordon called it off for non-performance of the non-fulfillment of the conditions preceded. But it called upon Gordon to enter into a contract to increase the interest rate on his mortgage, and a contract not called for by the earnest money contract that he originally signed. Now, if I may, I submit another scenario under this assumed closing on July 27th. The provisions of the McGovern-Gurley letter require that Shuler and Reese, quote, will also be personally liable. Now, Reese was not even a party to this contract. The earnest money contracts, by its express terms, excluded any personal liability. The closing papers that had been prepared at Mr. Shuler's instruction, and they're attached to Plaintiff's Exhibit 14, and they were prepared to close the transaction, they include the wraparound note, which clearly excludes any personal liability. Any oral promises by Shuler or Reese that they would be responsible for this debt would be within our statute of frauds, would be unenforceable against them, because they're promising to answer for the debts of another, because this is the debt of Mr. Gordon, or this is the debt of Below Condo, Inc., a corporation which Mr. Shuler had designated as the buyer on the closing of this transaction. If either decided not to play this game and that he wouldn't execute that paper at any time after we closed this deal on July 27th, if either of them decided not to pay, what are the consequences? Declaration of default, acceleration, and forfeiture. Now, another scenario. The last provision says that Mr. Blanchett, quote, will prepare and be satisfied with all documents. And Mr. Blanchett did prepare those documents, and he forwarded them to me, counsel for Gordon, and to counsel for Mr. Shuler, some 30 days after the expiration of the time for closing this contract. When we examine these are in evidence as Plaintiff's Exhibit 13, along with the forwarding letter by which Blanchett forwarded. When we examine them, we find that there is a note amendment and assumption agreement that is a complicated legal document, and it is accompanied by an extensive opinion of counsel for Shuler that Blanchett said he would require closing. There is no evidence that the contract, the note amendment and assumption agreement that Blanchett contrived was acceptable to anybody. There's no suggestion that the counsel opinion that he would require could be made by Mr. Shuler's counsel. In Smith versus Sabine Royalty, which is cited in our case, it's a civil appeals case from Amarillo in 1977, the court said, where written instruments are contemplated on essential portions of an agreement, the parties are not bound until the instruments are executed. Clearly, this contemplated that definitive agreements would be drawn, approved by the parties, and executed. In short, the formal assumption and consent agreements would be executed. If on July 27th we had this hypothetical closing of this transaction, and if subsequent thereto the parties could not agree on the provisions that went into Mr. Blanchett's agreements, what would be the consequence? Default, acceleration, and foreclosure. Now, Mr. Boone argues in his petition that he should be relieved from conditions that are impossible of performance, conditional precedents that are impossible of performance, and he argues that a condition requiring an unconditional consent by the Boston Mutual is absurd. That's how he characterizes it. Well, you know what I know. It's not absurd. If this were a multi-million dollar deal that's with people represented by careful counsel, you know and I know that prior to the closing date, all escrows, indemnities, contracts, conveyances would have been worked out and approved by counsel. The assumption agreement and note amendment or whatever other forms, evidence and consent, would be worked out, and Boston Mutual would be at the closing to sign that consent, or else it would have been signed in Boston and given to the title company conditionally for delivery at closing. It's not absurd. It's a normal way to close it. And the idea of closing a contract on the last day in reliance on this is absurd. We could not even stop, hope to stop the Boston Mutual if we had closed in reliance on that letter, because it's not even addressed to us in no circumstance that even shows why it came into the possession of Schuler and his group. It's clearly so insufficient that it can't be said to be the type of consent that's contemplated by the contract to satisfy the condition precedent. It's true the contract does not say unconditional written consent. But if the contract had been conditioned that prior to closing, a release of the Boston Mutual mortgage would be obtained, is there anyone here that can validly argue that that could be conditional? In that situation, everybody knows that what you're referring to is a unconditional, legally binding release in reportable form. You cannot use every qualifying adjective, and it was not used here, but it's obvious that the contemplation of the parties were that it would be a consent sufficient to bind the Boston Mutual, and this writing is not such. Now, there's another and essential defect in it that I'd like to allude to. Now, as I stated, Mr. Schuler structured the manner in which this was to be closed, and its structure is disclosed by the closing papers attached to the title company's letter, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 14. This involved a conveyance, not to Schuler Reese & Company, but to Bello Condo, a corporation, heretofore not identified. The wraparound note specifically excluded personal liability, and the closing papers contemplated, at Schuler's suggestion, contemplated the creation of a third mortgage in the amount of $125,000 to secure money he was going to borrow from the Inwood National Bank in Dallas, so that he was going to borrow and assume indebtedness altogether in excess of the value of the property, the purchase price of the property. But now, in going to Boston Mutual to get consent to this transaction, what did Schuler and Reese request the Boston Mutual to consider and act upon? Reese's first formal request for Boston Mutual's consent is Plaintiff's Exhibit 12, and it's dated June 26, and it said, and I'm quoting from it, "We request your approval of the sale of Versailles Apartments, Dallas, Texas, from John T. Gordon to Harold R. Schuler, trustee. Mr. Schuler will be acting as trustee for the Schuler Reese & Company, a Texas general partnership owned 50% by Mr. Louis G. Reese III and 50% by Mr. Harold R. Schuler." And that's all quoted from his request. There's no mention of a third deed of trust for $125,000. And you'll recall that the Boston Mutual's deed of trust forbade the creation of inferior encumbrances.
Are you telling us that the papers that were prepared say that Shuler and Reese will not be personally liable?
Yes. The closing papers say that, Your Honor. Now, Mr. McGovern prepared a summary of the transaction to submit to his finance committee. It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 18. In that, McGovern states, Mr. Harold R. Shuler, trustee for the Shuler Reese & Company, wishes to purchase the premises for $432,000. Those are his introductory phrases. Again, in his submission to his finance committee, there is no mention of the third mortgage to be created. The action of the finance committee is in evidence as Plaintiff's Exhibit 19, and it acted favorably on a request to transfer to Shuler, quote, to Shuler Reese & Company, comma, Harold R. Shuler trustee. Now, McGovern testified, and it's in the record, he testified that neither he nor the finance committee had any information concerning the proposed third mortgage. The finance committee did not authorize consent to creation of a third mortgage. That the third mortgage was material to the Boston Mutual's decision. That he would not have recommended approval to the finance committee if he had known of the proposed third mortgage, or that Shuler proposed to borrow more than 100% of the purchase price. And he testified further that the Blanchett papers would not have been signed because those papers disclosed that a third mortgage was involved. In our Court of Appeals brief at pages 40 and 42, the statement of facts citations to support that are set out. Now, at page 42 of our lower court brief, you'll find cases cited that establish the doctrine that a contract induced by misrepresentation, whether innocent or not, cannot be enforced against the party so misled. In this instance, whatever consent you might be able to find in the McGovern-Gurley letter is based on an essential and important material misunderstanding of the transaction that was to be closed. Whatever legal force that McGovern letter might have, if any, against the Boston Mutual was entirely unavailable because it was induced by misrepresentations as to the character of the transaction. Now, it becomes very, very similar to the situation in the court of Clark in the case of Clark Investment Company versus Green, which Mr. Shuler cites in his application and mistakenly relies upon. In that case, the issue was whether consent was given to sale of mortgaged personal property. Clark Investment and Weisberg agreed upon a proposed contract of sale. They submitted that to the holder of the mortgage, Green, and requested his consent to sale of those chattels subject to his mortgage. He considered the proposed contract and wrote a letter granting a conditional consent. But thereafter, Green and Clark changed the deal and closed it in another form, in another manner. This court, the Supreme Court, in that situation, held that no consent was granted. The court stated, therefore, it is clear that everything in this letter, the consent letter, had reference to the sale of the hotel set forth in this proposed contract. When plaintiffs, under the terms of this letter, conditionally consented to a sale of the personal property covered by the chattel mortgage, they necessarily were consenting to the provisions of the proposed contract. It cannot be said they were consenting to the sale which was actually made, because that sale was materially different from the one they had been asked to consider. A consent to a particular sale is not a consent to any sale. Furthermore, plaintiffs have specifically conditioned their consent. Such a conditional consent given to the sale of personal property covered by a chattel mortgage does not give authority to sell unless the condition is fulfilled. On the last day for consummation of this agreement, on the day when this hypothetical closing would have occurred, it would have been a closing that was very, very materially different from the closing, the transaction that was described to the Boston Mutual and that was contemplated by John McGovern when he wrote that letter to his Dallas agent instructing her to proceed with getting consent done. Now, there's been a reference to here to the question of whether time was of the essence. That doctrine, that legal concept, has no application in this case because this is a condition precedent to the binding effect of this contract. The question of whether time is of the essence is in judging whether covenants have been timely performed. But the cases that are cited in our lower court brief establish without any question that and I understood from Mr. Boone's application that he agreed with the principle that a condition precedent to the effectiveness of the contract must be timely and exactly fulfilled.
Counsel, how many copies of your, you keep referring to your brief in the court below, how many copies, did you file those in this court?
No, sir. I filed an opposition to the
If you expect this court to read all those references to your brief in the Court of Appeals, it'll be behoove you to file some of those copies with us. There are 9 of us, and we generally have sent 1 or 2. Just a respectful suggestion.
Well, I appreciate the suggestion, and I'll certainly file copies of it. The reason I didn't, I thought the matter was covered by my opposition to the application for writ, but additional matters have come up here this morning that I didn't think...
You keep referring to it almost ever since you talked about it in your Court of Appeals brief. And we ought to have copies of those.
Your Honor, the question of ambiguity has come up here. I thought it was abandoned. And it was briefed and it's not preserved
on the
book.
It's your problem. It's not important to us. That's fine.
Well, thank you very much for the suggestion. I will do so. One other comment. Mr. Boone likes to characterize this as a transaction in which Mr. Gordon made a contract, got a better offer, and tried to renege. That's not a fair characterization of what happened. What really happened in this transaction is that early on, right after the contract was executed, Mr. Shuler called the Glenn Justice Company and his agents then assured Mr. Gordon that there's going to be no problem because of his prior record of many, many dealings with the Boston Mutual and with the Glenn Justice Company, there's going to be no problem and he'd take care of it. And then he didn't do anything. The contract was signed on April 28th. The first formal request for consent to this transaction was contained in Mr. Reese's letter dated June 26th. Nearly two-thirds of the time for obtaining the consent that was already gone before the formal application for a consent was made. Prior to the Boston Mutual to obtain a consent to prepayment and an agreement as to what the prepayment penalty was, because they intended to prepay it initially. But then on June 26th, with two-thirds of the contract period gone, they make the first formal application for consent to the assumption of the Boston Mutual's mortgage. They had 30 days approximately left to do. The closings were set, the evidence will reflect, closings were set for July the 2nd, July the 6th, and July the 24th. In each case, they were called off because the consent had not been obtained. Mr. Gordon was the only person who didn't get the word and attended the July 25th closing. That is not the action or conduct of a man who's trying to welch on his deal. I think that this, under no circumstances, can this be considered the type of consent contemplated by the condition of condition preceding the action of the lower court should be affirmed. My time is up. Thank you for your attentions and your questions.
May it please the court, just a few words in response. At the outset, Mr. Potts stated that the time for closing was 90 days from the execution. We respectfully ask the court to read the contract between the parties. It does not say the contract must be closed 90 days from the date of execution. We pleaded that the contract was ambiguous in the trial court. The trial court so found, introduced or admitted testimony with regard to the meaning of the final date for closing of that contract, and that testimony was not that it would be closed 90 days from the date of execution. Judge Barrow, you questioned whether or not the letter of consent would have to go to Mr. Gordon. I questioned Mr. Gordon about that in the trial court. He, of course, said, yes, I wanted to have it in his
words. Well, that's one way he'd know it was true, wasn't he? He'd have to hear some way.
He might find out about it in that way, but the question is not, and the contract does not require that Mr. Gordon have this consent in his hand. If it did, Mr. Gordon could simply not answer the door on the date of closing and avoid it that way. The contract doesn't specify by whom the consent must be obtained, how, you know, in what form, whether it be conditional, whether it be a letter, whether it be a legal document that's suitable for filing with the county clerk, and it doesn't state what it means by the word obtained. Obtained, in this sense, was accomplished in the sense of receipt, actual possession.
Well, it says written approval shall be obtained.
Yes, sir.
And it's not hard to figure out what that means, either.
Well, I beg to differ, Judge. Look at the purpose of what the clause is. It is to, as Mr. Potts said, prevent acceleration of the deed of trust and the note. Isn't acceleration prevented when Mr. Petrocelli obtains or possesses the consent, or when Nell Gurley obtains or possesses that consent, or even back a step further, back when John McGovern signs the letter of consent? I think that the purpose of the condition precedent is accomplished at that point. Not that it has to go to Mr. Gordon and be in his hands. And as Mr. Potts pointed out, this contract does not call for unconditional consent by the Boston Mutual. The contract could have, perhaps it should have been written that way. I don't know what other people do in other multi-million dollar deals. I'm sorry, but there's no evidence about those multi-million dollars.
I really can't see any difference in unconditional agreement and agreement. You agree to it and you don't. I can't get any difference in words if you've written a condition you agree to it than agree to it. Do you really see any difference?
No, sir, agree. They could have put that in there, but one way or the other, this agreement states, this letter states, we approve the transfer. Those are the key words. We approve the transfer. Now they go on and say we want to increase the interest rate. We want to make Shuler and Reese personally liable. conditional consent is not effective unless the conditions are fulfilled. That's the holding in the A.R. Clark Investment versus Green case. This court's opinion, conditional consent is not effective unless the conditions are fulfilled. Personal liability. I understood Mr. Potts to say that the papers, as finally drawn, did not require Schuler and Reese to become personally liable. This was the situation in the Clark versus Green case. They wanted the buyer to be personally liable, the mortgagee. The buyer said, yes, I will, and then they didn't.
I've understood him to say that Mr. Reese would not be liable, personally liable.
That was
my understanding.
Your Honor, at the on page 3, plaintiffs of the note amendment and assumption agreement, as drawn by Mr. Blanchett, paragraph 6, each of the undersigned, Harold R. Schuler and Louis G. Reese, the third individually, jointly, and severally, does hereby unconditionally guarantee the payment of the note, and it goes on.
Did Schuler sign that or say he signed it?
No, this is...
That's the way Blanchett would have written the papers.
That is the way that Blanchett wrote the papers. And that is what Reese agreed to do. And this is what the jury found that Schuler was willing to do. Another thing that Mr. Potts said was that you don't know about this willingness to bear or to indemnify because it's no better than the man's balance sheet. Well, that's probably true. I think that's definitely true. But the jury found, and this finding is not attacked on appeal, that Schuler was able to hold Gordon harmless. So the balance sheet question is not in this case. If the jury had just found that Schuler was willing to do it, but maybe he couldn't fulfill the obligation, we'd have an entirely different case. But the jury found that he was willing and able to do that.
Well, I don't see where that really has anything to do with it. My problem with the case is the Court of Appeals has said that as a matter of law, the question of whether approval was obtained, insofar as Boston Mutual letter could be said to constitute approval, not for the jury to determine, but one of law. Okay, then your contract, as far as I can determine, just says that you must obtain in writing the consent to transfer. Okay, then that leaves open a whole bunch of things. What is consent? Are they consenting to the transfer? We'll assume that that is a consent. But the question then of what the agreement between the buyer and the seller was is not mentioned in this contract of sale at all. And wouldn't that be a jury question as opposed to a question of law as stated by the Court of Appeals?
If I understood your question, I believe that it is a question of fact with regard to whether or not these conditions were or would have been fulfilled on the date of closing. I think it is a question of fact. There are several cases that hold that whether a mortgagee has in fact consented is to be determined by the jury. I have not had an opportunity to read the cases referred to by Mr. Potts and would request an opportunity to reply to his brief when he provides the court with these cases that hold that a mortgagee's consent is in fact a question of law. I did not feel that the cases cited by the Court of Appeals supported that position.
Well, that is that letter. We'll assume that is a consent to transfer. Okay. And it might have some, it does have conditions in it that are different from that set out in the original mortgage. But this contract did not require that they consent to an assumption. It required that they consent to a transfer. They consented to a transfer, but on different conditions than what was in the original mortgage. But as far as this contract is concerned, between this buyer and the seller, all I see is that a requirement that they consent to a transfer, not that they assume the original note, that they consent to a transfer and consent to a wraparound, which they did.
They did that. They consented to the transfer and the wraparound, subject to the condition that Schuler and Reese become personally liable. And the testimony and the jury finding is that in that instance...
But was that requirement in the original contract between Schuler and Gordon?
No, sir.
Okay.
That was not in the original contract between Schuler and Gordon.
Were there objections to the issues submitted to the jury?
A good point. There were several objections to the issues submitted to the jury. Nothing in regard to failure to inquire about the third lien. This is an issue where Mr. Potts says that the Boston Mutual fundamentally misunderstood this transaction. If so, he needs a finding of fact of fraud on the part of Schuler in misrepresenting this transaction to the Boston Mutual. He needs findings of fact that Boston Mutual would not have gone forward. Actually, the testimony was not, as he indicated, that they absolutely would have refused to have closed this transaction with the third lien, but rather that they would have considered it in light of how much equity remained in the property. Again, what security they had.
Was there a motion to judgment notwithstanding the verdict on the grounds that this was not a jury issue?
No. Your Honor, the issues were submitted to the jury without objection that they are not, I believe, I'm speaking just from memory here, but I do not believe there was an objection, and I do not believe that the motion for judgment notwithstanding complained that the issues were not issues for the jury. I believe...
Any other, since the jury found in your favor, are there any implied findings by the court in your favor?
Yes, Your Honor, there are implied findings that not only was Schuler willing and able to hold harmless Mr. Gordon, but that Reese was willing and able to do that, and that they would have done that on the date of closing, whether that be July 27th or a later date, as we contend.
I understood, counsel, that Schuler and Reese weren't even buying this individually.
Schuler and Reese...
That makes a big difference, seems to me, to Boston Mutual, this contract here. It turns out Schuler and Reese are simply trustees for someone that they haven't heard of.
Would make a big difference if the Boston Mutual perhaps had not known that Harold Schuler had signed this contract as trustee and or assigned. They were told from the outset that Harold Schuler was acting as trustee, that he had the right to assign the property. Now, if Harold Schuler transferred this contract to Ballou Condos, which, let's suppose this is not true, the purpose of that was for tax reasons. If Harold Schuler had transferred that to Ballou Condos, which had no assets and was unable to pay the Boston Mutual, we'd have a material matter that the Boston Mutual could complain about. But Harold Schuler was remaining personally liable on this note. Louis G. Reese was personally liable. The transfer to Ballou Condo Inc. was immaterial so far as Mr. Gordon was concerned, so far as the Boston Mutual was concerned. And again, there's no finding that it would have mattered. There's no request for an issue.
Is there any significance to the jury finding that Schuler was willing and able to pay cash instead of going through all this financing business and what was acceptable and what was not?
Yes, Your Honor. Even this is the bottom of the argument about the third mortgage. If it were material to the Boston Mutual, the jury found that Schuler was willing and able to structure the transaction differently.
Was that ever communicated at the time the negotiations were going along, at the time of the refusal?
I don't remember in the facts whether that was communicated before or after. I do recall that Mr. Gordon learned about the third lien prior to July 27th, that he expressed no objection. Had Mr. Gordon expressed an objection about the third lien, Schuler testified he would have done it differently. The purpose of that issue was that during the trial, so much ado was made about this third lien that we felt like it was better to go ahead and get a jury finding that the third lien would have not been in the transaction had anybody objected. And that was the purpose of that finding.
Most sellers that I have heard of don't want cash sales. They pay all their income tax in 1 year. And to me, this is irrelevant to this transaction. And most people frame their transactions in such a way to avoid piling all of their taxes up at one time.
I believe that the third lien is irrelevant to this transaction. I would point out, Judge Pope, that the pay cash referred to his ability not to have to borrow the $125,000 for the down payment. He would not be paying Mr. Gordon $432,000 in cash. That is not what the special issue number 7 says, or at least the way I read it. One final point with regard to the facts. The July 26th letter from Reese to McGovern. This may have been the first formal request, but the testimony is throughout statement of facts that Reese had been on the phone with John McGovern almost on a daily basis from the very outset. There is no contention that Reese or Shuler was at all less than diligent in obtaining the written approval. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted on written briefs and oral argument for both parties. The court will take a brief recess.